The public still does not know that sudden and major climate changes have occurred in the past and could be written into our future. Ice records from Greenland show things like a doubling of snowfall in 2 years or less. There were periods where the temperature went up 1 degree centigrade every year for 5 years. That's 100 times faster than our current warming. It's called abrupt climate change. That was the topic of the Nye Lecture given at the meeting of the American Geophysical Union last December 2014. The speaker was Dr. James White, a professor of geological sciences at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's also the director of INSTAR, the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. Jim White, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'd like to help spread some of the startling news you delivered at the Nye Lecture. First of all, what do you mean by abrupt climate change?
Well, what we mean by abrupt climate change is a change that's faster than we're capable of dealing with. And that's sort of the simple, kind of, you know, straightforward definition. We can give you scientific definitions that have to do with time and magnitude. But really, we're talking about things that we're not capable of dealing with either economically or socially, that happen too fast and are too big for us to handle.
And certainly it should happen within one lifetime, you say.
Yes. There's some time frames and size frames that we can place on this. Within a lifetime, or ideally, not ideally, but most of these changes occur in a matter of a few years. So they are of a magnitude that, you know, for example, temperature changes from Miami to Montreal kind of temperature changes occurring in a matter of 20 years, 50 years, something like that. In some cases, even faster than that. So these are big enough to be very noticeable and fast enough that it would be a shock to the system. It's safe to say we've not seen anything like that in the last several hundred years of recorded history.
Well, the people of Montreal might be happy with it, but I think chaos would resume if that happened. So you say we're concerned not just with abrupt climate change, but also abrupt impacts on human systems. Could you give us an example of that?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that a slowly changing environmental system, like a slowly changing temperature, could tip our systems over thresholds. I'll give you a couple examples. One is when large companies like Google and Microsoft have these big server farms, these big computer server farms. They have to have very expensive and sophisticated air conditioning because a lot of heat produced when these computers are turned on. If you're going to buy tens of millions of dollars worth of air conditioning, you want it to last for the full time period that it's supposed to last, which is about 30 years. If climate is changing slowly, then it's possible that this very expensive air conditioning system you bought isn't going to last 30 years, and it may fail after 15 years. That 15 years doesn't sound abrupt, but to a company that spent tens of millions of dollars on this piece of equipment, that is an abrupt impact, and it is a very undesirable impact because they will lose a lot of money because they did not consider that a slowly changing baseline, in this case temperature, would push a system that they purchased out of its ability. Another example, another very clear example, is the threshold height of the New York City subway system. There were many, many storms over the last 50 years that pushed a lot of water up towards Manhattan. And it wasn't until Sandy came along that extra 6 inches or so that was needed to hit the height of the subway system threshold was reached. And when that happened, a billions and billions of dollars type of problem became a multi-billion dollar type of problem because water was able to pour into the subway system and into the tunnels. So that is a very physical, obvious threshold that we have in our system. And in that particular case, it has to do with storm surges and sea level rise and things like that.
And I found a key teaching moment about tipping points in your story about the Niagara River. Please tell us about that.
Well, it's important to recognize that not all tipping points are going to be obvious. And it's entirely possible for us to pass them without really knowing about it. And the analogy I use is, suppose you are an explorer on the Niagara River. You don't know it's a Niagara River. All you know is it's a river. And you are canoeing down. And if you're prudent, you will stay near the shore because you don't quite know what's ahead on any river, any unexplored river. But if you're in a hurry and the Niagara River flows pretty swiftly, you get out in the middle of the river and you paddle along. As you're paddling along out in the middle of the river, you hear a roar. You're not quite sure what it is. And then by the time you realize that, hey, there could be trouble up ahead, it's too late. You cannot get to the shore in time. The current is too swift. And in that particular case, you passed a tipping point before you ever went over the falls. You are not going to survive the fall over the falls, and, you know, sadly, you're just as dead minutes before you go over the falls as you are when you go over the falls. And so this is an example of a tipping point that you really wanted to be prudent. You wanted to be cautious. You want to take some care and give yourself every opportunity to avoid that tipping point. And if you're not prudent, if you're not cautious, if you're out in the middle of the river, you may find yourself going over the falls without any recourse.
So let's look at what we know about abrupt climate change in the past. Can you give us sort of a nutshell of what science has discovered?
Yeah, our planet is capable of some very remarkable changes in climate. If you look at the ice core record, which is what I work on, you'll see changes of temperature of 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, mean annual temperatures, that happen in a matter of anywhere from a few years to 30, 40, 50 years. The rate of change of temperature today is about 1 degree C in 100 years, and we are very interested in that, and we're very nervous, if you will, about what this might mean. If you look at abrupt changes, you're looking at changes of a degree in 10 years, or a degree per year, which is 100 times faster. And there are even changes where you get 10 degrees in a year, which is 1,000 times faster. So these are changes that would be very, very obvious. I tell my students, imagine if you enrolled at in a college with an environment like in the southeastern United States, and by the time you graduate, you were in a climate of Minneapolis. That's the kind of change that would occur over that 4 or 5 years that it takes you to get through college. And obviously, we've not seen anything like that in the last couple hundred years, but nature tells us that our climate system is capable of these sorts of changes, and many of them have indeed occurred.
Well, this brings out two questions in my mind. First of all, how certain are we about the information in the ice cores?
Well, the information in the ice cores is quite good. We have measurements of temperature changes by a number of different methods. We don't just rely on one or two. We can actually see annual layers in ice cores, even going back 20,000 years. And I think the other important key is that we see these changes not just in one ice core. We see them in all ice cores. And we see them in different degree from, say, southern Greenland to northern Greenland in a way that makes sense from a climatological point of view. We tend to see them less in southern Greenland where it's closer to the ocean and more in northern Greenland where it's farther away from the ocean. So replication of cores, replication of different ways of reconstructing the information. We're quite careful. And I would point out that when we first started to study these things, those of us who looked at them were just as doubtful of their reality as any normal human being would be. And it took us a couple of ice cores, two or three as a matter of fact, before we began to accept that these things were real and to study them in the kind of detail that we have now.
Now, my second question is, all right, we realize the temperatures in northern Greenland, say, went up 1 or 2 degrees in just 1 or 2 years. But what does that tell us about the whole planet? The Arctic is warming rapidly right now, but the global mean temperature is only going up slowly. Do abrupt changes in the Arctic really apply to the rest of us?
Great question. And it is the limitation that ice cores have, particularly in Greenland and Antarctica. You're seeing polar changes. And you're right. The amplification in the poles is going to be on the order of a factor of 3 or so. So if you see a 10-degree change in polar regions, that's probably in the neighborhood of a 3-degree change in at least hemispheric temperature. Maybe even global temperature. So there are many, many things we can do to kind of attack this problem. One is to look for these same kind of changes in ocean sediments, which are distributed around the world. We can also look for these changes in Antarctica and also look for the changes in cores that we see in mountainous regions like Tibet and the Andes, etc., to try to get a more global picture of what's going on. The changes I was talking about, particularly during the Ice Age, we see them all over the Northern Hemisphere. We see them in the coastal waters off of California. We see them in the waters off of Brazil. We see them all over the Atlantic and the Pacific. So these were hemispheric-wide changes. Interestingly, not very well expressed in the Southern Hemisphere, which is a big, as you know, a water hemisphere and less of a water and land hemisphere. So there are ways that we can try to look at the spatial distribution of these things.
All right. Now, they happened in past ages. Are there abrupt changes happening now?
There are abrupt changes happening now, and I think it's an important piece of information for I think all of us to understand. Today, there are a number of abrupt changes. The ones that are very visible, one is the disappearance of sea ice in the summertime in the Arctic. There are some wonderful visualizations that you can get from NASA and from NOAA that show sea ice, not only in its extent, but very importantly, in its thickness over the last 20 years or so. And in that short period of time, 20 years or so, summertime sea ice has changed dramatically in the Arctic. It is now, it's gone from what used to be multi-year ice, which would be meters and meters thick and capable of handling a warm summer, to vast areas of the Arctic Ocean are now one-year ice, which is thinner. And for any of us who's lived in areas where ice melts in the springtime, you know that a really warm summer with the right wind conditions can remove that ice. And the reason why that is important is that the reflectivity of the planet, how much white stuff there is reflecting the sun's incoming energy, is extremely important to climate. And when you replace white reflective ice with blue ocean, you change dramatically the amount of energy in the Arctic. Other examples of abrupt change going on today, we're in the midst of one of the great species extinctions that the planet has seen. And this one is one that we human beings are the root cause of in terms of changing habitat, removing habitat, changing climate. So there are a number of ways in which we are causing abrupt changes today.
You are tuned to Radio Ecoshock. Our guest is Dr. James White from the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado, and we are talking about abrupt climate change. Now, Dr. White, in your talk at the AGU, you spent a lot of time talking about sea level rise. Why?
Well, the reason has to do with how certain we are that sea level rise not only is occurring, but will continue to occur. I think one of the things I hear back when I talk about the subject of climate change in public is people want to know, what are the things I can rely on? What are the things that are actually going to happen? And what are the things that we're not so sure about? You know, how do we, because our models are very good, but they're not great. So sea level rises for two simple physical reasons. One is that as air warms, water warms, and as water warms, it expands. The other thing that happens is warmer air and warmer water melt land ice and put that ice into the ocean. Those are both very simple, very straightforward physical realities. And if you look at the history of the planet over the last million years, as temperature cools, land ice grows. As temperature warm, land ice shrinks back into the ocean. And these are very faithful relationships. We now know on our planet, if it's going to be a warm planet, you're going to have high sea level. If it's going to be a cold planet, you're going to have lower sea level. So that kind of certainty is really important. And the other piece of this is the sea level doesn't change by inches. Sea level changes by hundreds of feet on the planet. And that's a hard lesson for many people to grasp, I think, because we're kind of used to sea level being level. But changes of 10, 20 feet in sea level is really nothing for the planet. 400 feet is the change that has occurred over the last million years, and 20 feet is really a small amount of that. 20 feet, on the other hand, is a huge impact for a city like Norfolk, Virginia, or Washington, D.C., or Miami, or Oakland, California. And so the impact of sea level on us, sea level change on us, is something that we're going to have to get used to and have to deal with.
And I presume, though, that it still wouldn't be necessarily an abrupt change. It might take thousands of years to reach 20 meters higher than today.
Well, it would probably take hundreds of years. But what's important to understand is that Niagara analogy. We don't know how irreversible some of the sea level rise is that's going on today. An example of that is the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. That's the smaller piece of that Antarctic ice sheet. When you Google and look at Antarctica, it's that lobe. There's about 6 meters, so, you know, 20 feet or so of sea level rise in West Antarctica. And West Antarctica, like other bits and pieces of Antarctica and Greenland, is its base is well below sea level, in places hundreds to thousands of feet below sea level. And so this is what we call a marine-based ice sheet, and these are inherently unstable ice sheets. When they start to melt, you can imagine this big chunk of ice, it loses its what we call a pinning point or grounding line. It begins to flow, and there's really nothing to stop that ice from flowing into the ocean. And it's really just a matter of physics. How rapidly can that ice flow? And it's not going to reverse itself very easily. It's not going to suddenly stop again and then reform as an ice sheet. So there's a certain irreversibleness of ice sheet behavior that we are beginning to try to understand, and we're nervous about that, quite frankly.
Right. Well, you know, I've also heard you say in video that the methane threat is not that great, and that's despite the findings, as you say, by scientists that in the past methane went up as much as 50% in a lifetime. What are your thoughts about the work of Natalia Shakova and her Russian counterparts warning about abrupt climate change driven by big increases in methane coming from shallow seabeds in the Arctic?
Well, our committee, the National Academy Committee, took a hard look at methane. And I think there's sort of two messages to get out there. One is there is as much carbon locked up in permafrost as there is in all coal, oil, and natural gas. And that permafrost is melting. And it is going to be a very large and very difficult positive feedback on the warming of the planet that we're causing by burning fossil fuels. The question is whether or not it's going to be abrupt. And when the committee began to look at this, there are good physical reasons for expecting that carbon to come out slowly rather than abruptly. And that's good news in the sense that we probably won't see large increases in methane in short periods of time. The bad news, obviously, is that once these systems start to melt and continue to melt, then that carbon still comes out. And you can imagine, you know, all the efforts that we put into managing carbon or having carbon trading agreements or putting a price on carbon. If nature gets into the game and begins to put as much carbon in the atmosphere as we do, it makes it very difficult for us to deal with that. So I don't want to minimize permafrost and what we call methane class rates as a really difficult part of the positive feedbacks that we're going to see. The question is whether or not it's going to be abrupt.
All right. Now, I'd like to get in another key quote from your lecture, and that is this one. When one generation is not willing to set aside short-term profits to deal with the benefit of their children, you're never going to solve this problem because we live on a water planet. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think what I tried to do in that lecture was, I think, tie back the simple physics of our planet to constraints that we face as human beings. It's no secret, you can look at the Earth from outer space, it's 70% water at its surface. Water takes a long time to warm up, and it takes a long time to cool off. And, you know, I tell my students, or when I give public lectures, put two pots of water on the stove. Put one with water in it and one without water in it. Turn the heat on identically. Go away for a couple minutes, come back, put your finger in the water. It's not going to be very warm. Put your finger in the other pot, and this is a thought experiment, folks. That sizzling sound you hear is the tip of your finger. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. That's another physical principle. So why is it the pot without water is very hot and the pot with water is not? And the answer has to do with the water's ability to absorb heat. The heat capacity of water is very high. What's happening today on our planet is that extra greenhouse gases are accumulating energy in the atmosphere, and most of that energy, 90-something percent of it, is going to warm up the ocean. What that means is there's always a delay between what we call the climate that CO2 would like to have. We have 400 parts per million CO2. That climate is very, very warm, but we don't have a 400 part per million CO2 climate yet. That won't come until the ocean warms up, which is 50 or 100 years down the road. So until one generation says, you know, I shouldn't have put all that CO2 in the atmosphere, you're never going to be able to deal with this problem. You're always going to be passing the climate problem on to the next generation. And that's a real key constraint, if you will, because we live on a water planet.
All right, now we're starting to run out of time, but I wanted to note that you did end your Nye lecture with three things that we need to do to prevent a climate catastrophe. Could you just list those out for us?
Yeah, as I've studied this problem, I'm a scientist, a physical scientist, but as I've studied this problem, I've begun to realize that the ethical side of the equation, the value side, is probably going to be the key to understanding how we're going to move forward. So I just gave you one, what I think is a very important value issue, and that is intergenerational issues. So I'm a father and a grandfather. I think it's very important. I want to see my kids have a great life. I want to see them have a better life than I have. That won't happen unless my generation thinks seriously about climate change. So growing up, in a sense, and actually valuing our kids in practice as much as we say in words is important. That's one value issue. A second value issue has to do with population. Population is one of the underpinning problems that we face today. We have 7 billion people and growing. As it turns out, the number one way in which population can be controlled on our planet is valuing women. So when women have value economically and politically, they have fewer children per woman. We live on a very male-dominated planet in a very male-dominated world, and that creates problems for us. And as I say to all my fellow males, you know what? Share some power, because it's going to be good for you. It's going to be good for the planet. The other message that I gave in that lecture was, we live in a world today where about 2 billion people simply can't afford to care about the environment. They're too poor. They're too worried about where they're going to get the next meal. They're too worried about their kids having shelter and food. Unless we have a world in which there's a minimum sort of economic base that people are comfortable enough that they can care about the environment, you're never really going to solve these environmental problems. They're going to burn coal. They're going to burn whatever they can. So you've got to think about wealth equity as well. So valuing our kids, gender equity, wealth equity, these are things that we need to do to move forward. And I think they are things that move us forward as a species as well. And so to me, this is very good news. Very good news that we need to be better people in order to be more sustainable.
I agree. That is good news. And I think we'll have to hope for an abrupt change in human readiness to deal with this mega problem. And those good things will happen with it. We've been listening to Dr. James White. He's the director of the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. There's lots of videos with James White, and I'll put links to some of them in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Right now, unfortunately, Jim's 2014 Nye Lecture is not freely available to the public. I have a recording of the talk, and I'll make some inquiries to see if anyone objects to posting that in my blog. I don't know. Jim, do you think I would have your permission, and do I need to ask the AGU if I can get that audio out there?
You need to ask the AGU, and you certainly have my permission. I would love to see it freely available.
All right. I'll check on that. If we can do it, it will be in my blog next week. Dr. James White, thank you for spreading science out to the public and for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.